Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
All right, everybody, we are in Exodus chapter 25, also known as Terumah. The word Terumah, of course, comes from the giving God a portion, or lifting up a portion, to take his portion. Exodus 25 through 27. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and let them take from me a portion. From every man whose heart motivates him, you shall take my portion. This the portion you shall take from them: gold, silver, and copper, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, linen and goat hair, red-dyed ram skins, tarshish skins, acacia wood, oil for illumination, spices for the anointment oil, and aromatic incense, shoham stones, and stones for the settings of the ephod and the breastplate. They shall make a sanctuary for me, so that I may dwell among them, like everything that I show you, the form of the tabernacle and the form of all its vessels, so shall you do." They made an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. You shall cover it with pure gold. From within and from without shall you cover it. You shall make on it a crown gold all around. You shall cast for it 4 rings of gold and place them on its 4 corners, 2 rings on one side and 2 rings on its second side. You shall make staves of acacia wood and cover them with gold, and insert the staves in the rings on the sides of the ark with which to carry the ark. The staves shall remain in the rings of the ark. They may not be removed from it. You shall place in the ark the testimonial tablets that I shall give to you. You shall make a cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits its length and 1.5 cubits its width. You shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Hammered out shall you make them from both ends of the cover. You shall make 1 cherub from the end at one side and 1 cherub from the end at the other side. From the cover shall you make them, the cherubim at its 2 ends. The cherubim shall be with wings spread upward, sheltering the cover with their wings, with their faces toward one another. Toward the cover shall the faces of the cherubim be. You shall place the cover of the ark from above, and into the ark shall you place the testimonial tablets that I shall give you. It is there that I will set my meetings with you. I shall speak with you from atop the cover, from between the 2 cherubim that are on the ark, the testimonial tablets. Everything that I shall command you, the children of Israel. You shall make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits its length, 1 cubit its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. You shall cover it with pure gold, and you shall make for it a gold crown all around. You shall make for it a molding of 1 hand breadth all around. You shall make a gold crown on the molding all around. You shall make for it 4 rings of gold and place the rings upon the 4 corners of its 4 legs. The rings shall be opposite the molding, as housings for the staves to carry the table. You shall make the staves of acacia wood and cover them with gold, and the table shall be carried through them. You shall make its dishes, its spoons, its shelving tubes, its pillars with which it shall be covered, of pure gold shall you make them. On the table shall you place showbread before me always. You shall make a menorah of pure gold, hammered out, so the menorah be made. Its base, its shaft, its cups, its knobs, and its blossoms shall be hammered from it. 6 branches shall emerge from its sides, 3 branches of the menorah from one side, and 3 branches of menorah from its second side. 3 cups engraved like almonds on the one branch, a knob and a flower, and 3 cups engraved like almonds on the second branch, a knob and a flower. So for the 6 branches that emerge from the menorah. And on the menorah shall be 4 cups engraved like almonds, its knobs and its flowers. A knob shall be under 2 of the branches from it, a knob under 2 of the branches from that, and a knob under 2 of the branches from that, for the 6 branches emerging from the menorah. Their knobs, their branches shall be of it all, of a single hammered piece of pure gold. You shall make its lamps 7. He shall kindle its lamps so as to give light toward its face. Its tongs, its spoons, shall be of pure gold. Of a talent of pure gold shall he make it, with all these vessels. See and make according to their form that you are shown on the mountain. Chapter 26. You shall make the tabernacle of 10 curtains, linen twisted with turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool. A woven design of cherubim shall you make them. The length of a single curtain, 28 cubits, its width, 4 cubits for each curtain. The same measure for all the curtains. 5 curtains shall be attached to one another, and the other 5 curtains shall be attached to one another. You shall make loops of turquoise wool at the edge of the single curtain at the end of one set. You shall make the same on the edge of the outermost curtain on the second set. 50 loops shall you make the first curtain, and 50 loops shall you make the end of the curtain that is on the second set. Loops shall correspond to one another. You shall make 50 hooks of gold. You shall attach the curtains to one another with the hooks, so the tabernacle shall become one. You shall make curtains of goat hair for a tent covering over the tabernacle. 11 curtains shall you make them. The length of a single curtain, 30 cubits, and the width of a single curtain, 4 cubits, the same measure for all 11 curtains. You shall attach 5 of the curtains separately and 6 of the curtains separately. You shall fold the 6th curtain over the front of the tent. You shall make 50 loops on the edge of the first curtain at the end of one set, and 50 loops at the edge of the second, of the curtain of the second set. You shall make 50 hooks of copper. You shall bring the hooks into the loops and attach the tent to become one. As for the extra overhang of the curtains of the tent, half the extra curtain shall hang over the back of the tabernacle, and the cubit on one side and a cubit on the other side, that are extra in the length of the curtains of the tent. They shall hang over the sides of the tabernacle on one side and over the sides on the other side to cover it. You shall make a cover for the tent of red dyed ram skins, a cover of tekash skins all above. You shall make the planks of the tabernacle of acacia wood standing vertically, 10 cubits the length of each plank, and a cubit and a half the width of each plank. Each plank should have 2 tenons parallel to one another, so shall you do for all the planks of the tabernacle. You should make the planks for the tabernacle 20 planks for the south side, and you should make 40 silver sockets under the 20 planks. 2 sockets under one plank for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under the next plank for its 2 tenons. The second wall of the tabernacle on the north side, 20 planks. There are 40 silver sockets, 2 sockets under one plank, and 2 under the next plank. For the back of the tabernacle on the west, you should make 6 planks. You should make 2 planks for the curtains, or for the corners, on the tabernacle in the back. They should be even at the bottom, and together shall they match at its top for a single ring. So that shall it be for them both, the two corners shall they be. There shall be 8 planks and their silver sockets, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under one plank and 2 sockets on the next plank. You shall make bars of acacia wood, 5 for the planks of one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars of planks, the second side, the second wall of the tabernacle, and 5 bars of planks of the tabernacle, the wall at the back. On the west, the middle bar inside the planks shall extend from end to end. You shall cover the planks with gold. Its rings you shall make of gold, as housings for the bars. You shall cover the bars with gold. You shall erect the tabernacle according to its manner, as you will have been shown on the mountain. You shall make a partition of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and linen, twisted. A weaver's craft shall he make the curtain, with woven design of cherubim. You shall place upon it 4 pillars of acacia wood, plated with gold, with hooks of gold upon the 4 silver sockets. You shall put the partition under the hooks, and you shall bring it there, inside the partition, the Ark of the Testimonial Tablets, and the partition shall separate for you between the Holy and the Holy of Holies. You shall put the cover upon the Ark of the Testimonial Tablets, in the Holy of Holies. You shall place a table outside the partition, and a menorah opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And the table you shall place on the north side. You shall make a screen for the entrance of the tent of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, and twisted linen, and embroidered craft. You shall make for the screen 5 pillars of acacia wood, and cover them with gold, and their hooks shall be gold, and you shall cast for them 5 sockets of copper. Chapter 27. You shall make the altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits in length and 5 cubits in width. The altar shall be square, 3 cubits its height. You shall make its corners. You shall make on its horns, on its corners, 4 corners, and from it shall its horns be, and you shall cover it with copper. You shall make its pots to clear the ashes, its shovels, its basins, its forks, its firepans. You shall make the vessels all of copper. You shall make for it a netting of copper of meshwork. Make upon the meshwork 4 copper rings at its 4 edges. You shall place it under the surrounding border of the altar from below, and the meshwork shall go to the midpoint of the altar. You shall make staves for the altar, staves of acacia wood, and you shall plate them with copper. Its staves shall be brought into the rings, and the staves shall be on 2 sides of the altar when it is carried. Hollow boards shall you make it, as you were shown on the mountain, so shall they do. You shall make the courtyard of the tabernacle on the south side, the lacings of the courtyard, 8 twisted linen, 100 cubits long for one side, its pillars 20 and their sockets 20. Of copper, the hooks, the pillars, the bands of silver. So too for the north side, in length, lace hangings, 100 long, its pillars 20 and the sockets 20, also of copper. The hooks, the pillars, and their bands of silver, the width of the courtyard on the west side, lace hangings of 50 cubits. Their pillars 10, their sockets 10. The width of the courtyard on the eastern side, 50 cubits, and 15 cubits of lace hangings on the shoulder. Their pillars will be 3, their sockets 3. The second shoulder, 15 of lace hangings, their pillars 3 and their sockets 3. At the gate of the courtyard, a screen of 20 cubits, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, twisted linen, of an embroidered craft. Their pillars 4 and their sockets 4. All the pillars of the courtyard, all around, banded with silver, their hooks of silver, their sockets of copper. The length of the courtyard, 100 cubits, the width, 50 by 50, the height, 5 cubits, of twisted linen, and their sockets of copper. All the vessels of the tabernacle for all its labor, all its pegs, and all the pegs' courtyard shall be copper. A lot of reading of that one. So, really helpful you had a picture, huh? Yes, Jared. Coming up with the microphone for you.
How do they know what the cherubim looked like?
Great question. I had to study that myself, too. Because we look, okay, what is a cherubim? Well, we could look up online, and they have various artist interpretations of this thing, of that thing, of all this various stuff that they may have looked like. Notice our Torah scrolls don't come with photographs. Sorry, I wish they did, but they don't. If they did, it'd be really simple. We'd say, it looks like this, and show it to you. So God used descriptive terms only. Now, to determine what something is and what something isn't is almost impossible using just words. The way we figure things out is by comparison. So if God has cherubim around him at all times, well, is there anything within side the information we have of the Torah or even of the Tanakh, or is it the Tanakh or the New Testament at all, to give an idea of what a cherubim would be? Jared, what do you think it would be?
Doesn't it say so in, I think it's Isaiah or Ezekiel?
It discusses some of these, yes. That's where we get some of our information from. Now, note, because we have the description of cherubim meaning to be made on the tabernacle curtains, Ezekiel, which is who's recording in chapter 40, 41, 42, 43, oh, the latter half of his book, discusses what he sees in the temple that God has designed in heaven. And we get a lot of information from him. But the cherubim that he describes is not complete, but it gives us an idea at least of what one of the cherubim could look like. Yes, Daniel.
Well, there's several places afterwards where it says that make them according to the design being shown to you on the mountain.
Right.
So why wouldn't he have seen the cherubim on the mountain as well?
And we're going to talk about that today. What did he see? That's a good question. What did he see? Which is how he gets his idea of the cherubim. Fortunately, our Bibles do describe gives a good idea of what he actually saw. Yes.
But are they the same as the four living creatures that are surrounding him on the throne?
That would be one of the, yes, it's one of the common interpretations as what those creatures look like. Now, of course, our Bibles don't give us a detailed description of what they look like per se. It gives a type of being that has, unique characteristics. So, the eyes have different tasks, and we'll discuss those a little bit. So, let's discuss just briefly, what is a cherubim? The idea behind them, they are guard-like angels. The intent is, the angel's function is for a guard or protector type of functionality. So, a cherubim. So, the idea is a guard. Now, they've described it for theirs. Obviously, we have in Ezekiel as well as in Revelation, Ezekiel describes it at two different locations. The cherubim have, not all, but some of them contain, as Ezekiel describes, a lion-like face. He describes that when he discusses the engravings that are etched on the doorposts all around the temple that he is having in his vision, that John's measuring for him and John's giving the dimensions. So we have a lion-like face for what Ezekiel sees at his time. We also have early, this is recorded in Ezekiel, I think it's chapter 40 and 41. There's like five, six chapters, like 46 or 47 when he actually stops talking. But a lot of chapters he discusses what these things look like. We also have in Ezekiel chapter 1, describes what he sees on God's throne. Now, God's throne, it has more descriptive characteristics of these lion-like faces. It has not just a lion face. It includes a lion face around God's throne. It also includes an eagle, a man, and a calf or a cow, the calf. Ox are they're very similar. They're a bull-like animal. Yes, the similar type of animal. So these are other three descriptions Ezekiel gives us, and of course, John reiterates the three descriptions as well. So as far as the knowledge we have of what cherubim have, the most common one described in our Bible, means most frequently, is the lion face. Now, they also contain wings of some form. Now, we can discuss what that means, but in the description, Ezekiel gives a description of all of these around God's throne, and John does as well. They all have multiple sets, or two sets of wings. But in the first, when Ezekiel's describing what he sees etched on the door, on the doorpost of the temple, is a single set of wings. What I want to draw your attention to is when Ezekiel records his single set of winged cherubim etched on the doorpost of the temple in his vision, they are not looking at God. What are they looking at? Remember what they look at? They're looking at something in particular, etched all the way around. They look at something called a palm tree. My microphone's picking it up. I apologize.
What verse is that?
That would be, it's Ezekiel, those seven chapters. Discuss it. They face the palm trees as they're looking at it. So the cherubim, they're, now we understand the general use is a guard-like creature or guard-like being designed to do a task on God's behalf. In Ezekiel's description of just this particular one, the lion-faced one, he knows that they are focusing their attention on palm trees. Now, we already understand, when we've studied before and learned, that the righteous are likened unto trees. And we learned from Sukkot, palm trees is supposed to be the righteous man who bends but does not break under the stress of life, what God tests him. Implied in that is that the cherubim's focus is to pay attention to the righteous individuals that their job is to protect. Does that make sense? That's the interpretation using those elements alone. Any questions about that? Pretty simple, pretty basic stuff. I won't necessarily say it's you have to agree with me. I didn't come up with it. Somebody else did. But I'm just regurgitating what they said regarding that particular interpretation. So cherubim have these characteristics. I do not know on the tabernacle, on the ark, which face it had. It's not recorded. So we don't know. It could have been any one of these. It could be a fifth face not recorded. We don't know. So I can't answer what everything looked like, but that's a general idea of what they are intended to look like. Any questions regarding that? Okay. We'll discuss more about them a little while later as to why they're there, but we won't get to that point yet. Okay, let's jump into this, shall we? Go ahead. The cherubim are recorded in our reading. We said the cherubim were etched in embroidered work on the linen curtains that were wrapped around the entire tabernacle, back to forth, continuously. They were also mounted on top of the ark itself, which we had just read today. So both the fact that cherubim are used all around the tabernacle curtains, on both the inner sanctuary and the outer curtains, as well as, of course, put on the ark itself, they are a somewhat important characteristic God intended for us to use or learn from. Make sense? Yes.
So you're saying that...
The ones recorded in Ezekiel have lion faces. The ones in Ezekiel 40, 41, 42, 43, 45, 46. That is lion faces. I don't know what the faces of these look like in Moses' time in Exodus. We don't know. Yes, Daniel.
The commandments were told not to make any idols.
Yep. What's up with this?
Yeah, exactly.
I was hoping you'd ask that question. Oh, yes, Anne.
You usually answer the question in your speaking. Unless you're going to answer Daniel right now.
Go ahead. I intend to talk about that particular topic in the speaking. Yes.
All
go
right.
ahead, Anne.
So my Bible says brass, and brass is an alloy, and you say copper. So which one is it?
We can discuss a little bit about that.
Okay.
So, in Hebrew, the Hebrew terminology, brass, bronze, and copper is the same word. Brass, bronze, and copper is the same word. So it doesn't matter which one it is. And the reason is because how do you make bronze copper? You take a copper and mix it with another alloy, some of the other metal. You can mix it with aluminum, steels, and any, and put copper into it, it makes it bronze. A lot of different forms of bronze. How to make brass, same way. You take copper and mix it with any other metal. You contaminate the copper and make it into this new brass component. And of course, how do you make copper? It's copper. it's an alloy mixture. It's how you use them. So in Hebrew, the brass, bronze, and copper, everybody knows it comes from copper as the adding element, the component which you're adding to something else. So that's why they use them all interchangeably. They're all copper-based metals. Does that make sense? Silver is separate, gold is separate. You can obviously mix copper with those two metals, though it doesn't help you. Well, that's not true. That's how we get sterling silver. You've heard of sterling silver before? Yeah. That's a mixture of copper and silver. I don't know if they mix gold and copper. I've never heard that done before. But sterling silver is a copper and silver mixture, as opposed to pure silver, which is not. They don't mix them. They mix sterling silver on purpose because copper oxidizes and turns a greenish, like, funky color, and silver oxidizes to, like, a black color. But when you mix copper and silver, their color tarnishing diminishes. They don't tarnish as quickly because they both help each other out, keeping it looking more like silver. So we call it sterling silver. Does that make sense? There's purposes why you add them, but that's a separate issue. Yes? Go ahead.
Psalms 92, the righteous shall flourish like the palm tree, and he shall grow like the cedars of Lebanon.
Yep.
So God equates the palm tree with righteousness.
The righteous. Yep.
And that's what we're
talking about. That's the whole point. So since we understand the cherubim's functionality is a guard-like protection function, not they have to be always, but that's their general idea. In Ezekiel's description, when he sees the cherubim facing the palm tree, what are they guarding or looking at? A righteous individual, righteous person. They're guarding and protecting what is righteous. Make sense? It is a uniquely designed, yes. Yeah. The palm tree, creation is a uniquely designed tree. It's a very fibrous interior designed to withstand and bend and flex and even open up if something penetrates it and close back up again. It has unique properties of the tree. And that's what makes it so valuable in what it's used. It's completely worthless to build with it. It's too fibrous. But standing on its own, it's very strong and useful. Yes, Jared.
Where did they get the wood?
That's
a
great question.
They didn't schlep all of that.
Shittim wood.
Feet.
Yeah. Shittim wood and acacia wood, which is, they're two different words for the same thing. Acacia trees. I'm not sure how familiar you are with Africa. I'm not. Yeah, I don't usually go to Africa often. Some of you might. Yes, Larry.
Acacia trees grow in
Yes.
Desert.
Yes.
Borders of desert.
Yes. Acacia are an arid.
Very hard wood. It's like our manzanita.
Yep. It is very thorny. It can grow very tall, though. I saw a picture of one. It can grow very tall. Acacia trees, they're very prevalent in African continent. They are the preferred food for elephants. That's their preferred food choice. They are very thorny. As far as when they're young, but elephants like to eat them, and of course they have thick skin, they don't even care. But it's very, very common tree at that time, but its advantage is it does not decay readily in that environment. Yes, Diane.
Just to the cherubims for a minute. So
go
they're
ahead.
Like a guard protecting something, but do they represent the righteous government of God? I mean, they're executors of righteous and holy judgment.
That's an interesting question. It's difficult to answer that question. The only examples we have of what they're actually doing, we only have two examples given to us. Ezekiel's example, which they do nothing. Their job in Ezekiel's example is to do absolutely nothing. And then in John's example, they speak, they talk. So Ezekiel's example, they don't even talk. They're not permitted to do anything else, just stand there. But John said they're allowed to speak. So what they control is very difficult to determine. But we'll discover a little bit more about them as we learn more about how this temple is laid out, the tabernacle is laid out, and what the symbols are used for. It might give us some insight as to explaining their function and why God would choose them. Yes.
One more.
Go ahead.
When I'm studying the tabernacle, and I've got a long way to go with it for sure, But it was always seems to me that everything that's in that tabernacle points to Yeshua.
In many ways, it does. The tabernacle itself, as you'll notice when you lay it all out, a topographical view of the entire thing, as well as all the tribes around it. You see a funny parallel. There's a picture inside of a picture inside the design, but we also have repetition of that design in John's description. He uses different words, of course, but the characters are all there. So we have an idea of what Moses may have seen, but through John's description, because what John described and how Moses was interpreting those things, the viewpoint, exactly. So we have, we'll hopefully talk about those a bit today when we get to these different components and let it go along.
Information on them other than in Ezekiel, and
right,
where they're saying nothing, and then in John. But something hit me. I mean, I don't, is like if they represent righteous judgment, who's Christ?
That's an interesting question. In the story given to us in John, the cherubim are distinctly separate from him. The Messiah is a character in front of them that he is addressing them, speaking to them. That's the description given to us in John, or speaking at them or being in their presence. So to interpret whether they are a symbolic representation of him, maybe, hard to say. But since he characterized himself as different from them, but Christ said, I am separate from these characters, obviously you can see, as John's vision shows, but they are still dependent on him. So they are separate from him, but they need him to continue on the task. So it's hard to say what they represent in that way, other than in a manner of speaking, I'm using this term loosely, they become servants to him in a manner of speaking, because they need him in order to finish off the job that God wrote down for them all. So they need him to do the job. I don't know how they represent him necessarily other than that. But we might be able to discuss that more in detail. But let's move forward. Acacia, where'd they get the wood? It's common in Africa, common Middle Eastern territory. It was readily available. Mind you, the Middle East today is a desert. It wasn't then. It was a forested area. I say forested because that's what the Bible describes it as. We interpret our things as the wilderness. The Hebrew word there, so off the wilderness of this, wilderness of that, the Hebrew word means forest of that, or forest of this. Now, according to Roman records, it was a forest many years prior, before they all got cut down. I won't discuss who cut them all down. One guess. The guys who were cutting it down probably wrote about the fact that, hey, look at the forest, all these trees were used to cut down. They're probably part of it. Others did as well. Jeremiah describes it as a forested area. The Middle East was a forested area. So having trees there was probably relatively common, but also with lack of rain, lack of proper care of land, it doesn't last long. So human beings tend to destroy stuff. We're really good at the destroying part. The building, not so good, but destroying were really great. Just keep an eye out and we'll destroy it for you really happily. So things didn't happen. So acacia would have far more common then than it is now. Let's move forward. Oh, another question regarding that? Good. Okay. Okay, open up. Verse 2. Chapter 25 of Exodus, verse 2. I have a question for you.
We didn't talk about the false idols.
We're going to get there. I can't talk about it yet. We'll get to that in a moment, because that false idol is an important discussion about this, what we're talking about today. Chapter 25, verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel and let them take a portion, or take from me a portion. For every man whose heart motivates him, you shall take by portion. Yeah, keep reading verse 2. This portion you shall take from them. Gold, silver, copper, turquoise, purple, blah, 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 all the various things are rounding off the taking. When is it in your head or in your mind to be motivated for someone else to take your stuff?
What? Say that again.
When are you motivated, meaning willing to give, for somebody else to take your stuff? What was that? Hold on.
In a crisis.
A crisis? Any other event which you would be motivated for someone to take your stuff?
Fire. When they saved your life.
When they saved your life, you owe them something. They feel like an obligation. Daniel, what's your...
When there's thunder, lightning, loud trumpets, and a loud voice.
You're scared to death? What's yours? How does yours read? Of chapter 25, verse 2.
It reads, "Speak to the children of Israel that they take up a contribution for me."
Right. The word contribution.
Let me finish.
Go ahead.
Everyone whose heart moves him shall take up my contribution.
Right.
So basically he's telling you what yours is mine and be loose with it, not so tight.
Well, that's the point. He's telling Moses, you will take my portion, which mind you, we'll discuss what the portion means, what they are motivated to give. Motivation means you were desiring to give away. So at what circumstances are you willing to give for somebody else to actually take, as opposed to just give? So, for example, if I have a child, I say, child, here is a gift, I give it to you. As opposed to, child comes to me, daddy, you have a gift in your hand, give it to me. That's what the actual words are saying. That's what actually saying. And I'll point that to you. It's an interesting problem. It's not a problem, but it's an interesting scenario to understand what we're doing and how we do things. It's really critical to understand this point. What is going on here? How is this making us understand things, changing what it means to give? Yes, Larry.
Especially in the Oriental culture, when you have a guest that's coming to stay with you, they have a choice of anything that they like.
Anything you want.
And
yep.
if they just say, boy, I really like that, you say, that's yours.
Yep, yep, yep.
It's exactly it has something to do with it.
A lot to do with that. Your hand up. What was your question or comment?
Okay, my comment is that it's almost like they don't want any contributions being made without the right heart of wanting to give it.
That's how we understand what giving truly means. These understandings of what this means. So you go ahead, Daniel.
Well, a basic, it's a need. They're presenting a need. Just like when the fire swept through here, there was a great need and people just poured out their contribution.
Yep. And people were willing to take and receive it, which is a blessing. They're understanding what it means to give and take. Yes.
So perhaps we shouldn't be so clingy to our stuff and just be more... treat it like it's not ours. It's a loan or something.
Because what does God say in Psalms 24? Psalm 24. Yeah, the whole earth, Psalms 24. The whole earth. Earth is spelled with an E. E-A-R. Whole earth. Now, what isn't in the earth? What isn't there? The stars, maybe. But does God own those too?
Yeah.
Yeah, he built them. So is there anything, just think, any object you can think of that you can have and say, here, God, that he doesn't already own? What was that? Yourself. There's something unique about yourself. When you're giving something, he doesn't care if it's a rock, if it's a piece of gold, if it's food, or it's because he owns them already. If my daughter comes and says, hey, daddy, I grabbed your pencil out of your pen. So yes, and I'm giving it to you as a gift. It's like, thanks. That's very kind of you. Thank you. But I already own it. It's all right. But I thank you. But look what I did. Thank you. Because it's the act of her taking something that she perceives is a gift and giving it. But humans do it too. So if I come along to a congregation or a business and say, here, I want to do something for you. I want to help you in this way. Well, if the business or congregation already owns it, then I'm not doing much for them. But what is it that I am doing for them? It has nothing to do with the object. It's what's inside me that's doing it. So when God says I want a gift or offerings or contributions, it's not the stuff that really matters. It's the person willing to give the stuff that matters. It's a person's desire to give. That's what he's after. As Larry pointed out, it's yourself. It's what's inside you he wants. The stuff, the rock, the gold, the fabric, he owns all those. There's nothing different about that. It's the person's act of giving that is actually matters. Yeah, exactly. That's that objective. Sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit past now, but...
That's right.
No, I'm sorry. But the thing was, is that people give sometimes when they have an abundance of something. You know, I noticed
we'll discuss
that when you have
that
a lot of something, you're like, you know, like, I feel like, man, I have this stuff at my house. I want to give it away because I have so much of it and I get it. And I like to give it because I don't like to see it go to waste.
All right.
You know, and then, but then I try to give it away and people don't want it.
And it multiplies in the garage. Your stuff has babies. yes, it does do that. So we're learning this idea of give and take. When God's referring to take it, it's already his anyway. It's almost like me saying, here, Moses, here is my thing. Take this. The idea of taking is that the God already owns it anyway. I'm just going through this person over here who's going to give it to you. That's the idea of taking. God already owns it. Hence the idea of take it. He already owns it anyway. No difference. So understand that when it's a take. When we offer an offering, whether it be for a person who is poor, you're giving them something they need, whatever it may be. Remind you, God already owns that thing, whatever it is. All you're doing is he's pointing out, you're inspired to say, well, God, this thing is yours. I'm giving it to this person who think will benefit from it. That's the objective. That's the idea of giving, an offering, whatever it may be. It could be gold, silver, money, time, conversation, a book. It makes no difference what it is. The idea of giving it, even your love or compassion to somebody for their suffering. Yes, Diane.
Oh, I was just reading 2 Corinthians 9:7, the New Living Translation. You must each decide in your heart how much to give, and don't give reluctantly or in response to pressure, for God loves a person who gives cheerfully.
Right. Hence the idea of how we understand the giving. It's important. It's the inside that matters, the value of it. Yes, Daniel.
So, when they were told to leave Egypt, go to your neighbors and ask for all their
valuables. Ask for all the stuff, yep.
So all the stuff wasn't theirs to begin with.
But so it didn't belong to Egypt to start with.
It was sort of a test, like, are you going to get back to me what I gave you when you were leaving?
Exactly. It wasn't even yours. It was a gift to you to start with. So use the gift in this way. And they do. We will read more about all the stuff they give. They give so much that Moses says, stop. We have too much. Quit it. Keep some of it. We don't need any more. We have enough to do this plus more. So stop. So they learn they have an abundance. But you're right. It was a gift to them to start with. It wasn't originally theirs. Well, it was payment for the slavery, blah, 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 blah. Not really. That wasn't pay for slavery. Go free. That pays your slavery. Thank you. I'm free. They had that. The money and the stuff and the lapis lazuli and the gold and the silver. Those aren't truly payments. Those were just stuff. And God used them. It was using them. That was the intent. So he was plundering Egypt in order for them to build something for this big massive tabernacle. Which of course he wanted to, we'll discuss more about how that was built as we go on. Let's see here. Hold on a minute, I'll get that out. So in that statement of chapter 25, in a Hebrew phrase, let's see, 25, 26, 24. Ah, okay. So if I was going to read this, this is a transliteration of the words, all right? That's not the correct word. It's not exact. It's close. Say, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and make them take for me a raised up portion from every man that he is motivated within his heart. You shall take it, and my raised up portion. This is my raised up portion that you shall take from them their gold, silver, and copper." That they were motivated to say here. That was the idea. You shall take it. It's the idea of taking it, but it doesn't belong to them to begin with. It's not really start theirs. Even our stuff isn't our stuff. It doesn't matter if my truck, my car, the rock, my shoe, it's not mine anyway. It's just stuff that God's saying, you can use this until you don't need it anymore, so I take it away. Yes, Tammy.
I actually like the Septuagint's translation.
They do a really good job. You go ahead and read that. That was a good one.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and take for me first fruits from all of those to whom it seems good in their heart, and you shall receive my first fruits. Mm-hmm. And this is the first fruits that you shall take from them. Gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, double scarlet, and twisted linen and goat's hair, and red dyed ram skins and blue skins and decay resistant wood.
Yeah, Septuagint uses the word first fruits, which is perfectly fine. It's a legit example. The teruma, which is the giving up, the part set aside, there is not a direct English translation for that Hebrew concept. Well, Bikurim is, but as far as this idea of teruma, this identification, I will draw it for you to explain what we would describe it in English. But it's not really an English word. So before I get there, go ahead. What was your question?
It just reminded me also, you know, after Jesus came back with his, after the resurrection, and the first community church that was gathered, and they were all called to donate, you know, whatever they wanted from their hearts, you know, as we were all going to be like one and have everything in common. So. Yep. There's another example, and they were the first fruits, so that's kind of cool. That ties in.
And we're going to read a little about that today, hopefully, if I get to it. The part of that description. It's a great where you're going as far as you need to go as well. Let's pretend my diagram here is very simple. I realize that. Pretend this diagram represents all your stuff. You can fill in whatever you want in the squares. This represents all your stuff. The part taken away or taken lifted to God. It's stuff that you have set aside, but you haven't done anything with it yet. All right? I'll do a circled area. Let's say you have, let's pretend there's gold, silver, jewelry, money, whatever, I don't care. And you set aside this part, but you haven't done anything with it yet. You have mentally set it aside. This belongs to somebody else. But you didn't actually do it. You've mentally done it, but you haven't done it yet. That's what this is. That mental or emotional set aside, this I should give such and such, whatever it is, for this application. But you haven't done it yet. It's just the idea of doing it. We can interpret that in the form of like a savings account, so to speak. You have an account. You are slowly putting things in there. You don't know what you're doing with it yet, but you're saving or setting it aside for a purpose that is not defined yet. Make sense? That's what the Hebrew word would describe for this application, what they're doing here. It's not physically done, not until after somebody comes along called Moses and says, I will now take that portion.
Oh, I see.
Make sense? It's like he has the access to that savings account and said, I'm going to drain it today. He takes it. And it's perfectly good because that's what it was used for. You say, that's great. It wasn't mine to begin with. I'm just making deposits. Make sense? It's a way of how we can describe it in English, because you didn't do anything with it yet, but somebody else has to do it to it, not you. They've got to do it. Yes, Anne.
Is that in place of the tithe, or the tithe is separate?
This is completely separate. Completely separate. This is a portion you have set aside because you don't know what it's for yet. It has nothing to do with tithe. Tithe, we know what tithe is for. This, you don't know what it's for, and it's not yours to give, per se. It's for somebody else to take. Say, tithing, we use it, we give it away, do whatever we're doing with it. But in this case, the idea is that somebody else is taking it from you, not you giving it. Makes sense? But you have set aside for that giving purpose.
So every first fruit, and then back in the day, it would be your vegetables, your fruits, or oil, or whatever.
Yep.
So how do you know, is it just a person in need? I mean, what are you talking about? Because I'm not getting it. I'm sorry.
Well, okay, so wait, are you referring to then or are you referring to now?
Both.
Okay, these are two different things. Then the person in need was Moses because he was going to build a tabernacle. That was the person in need. In today's life, I don't know all the people that you know. So I can't tell you in your life who is in need. You know them. I don't. So I can't tell you then. So that's why it's set aside. You don't know what it's for because you don't know who or what that's for yet. Moses comes along and says, I know what it's for. Give it to me. I will take it from you.
So God put it on their heart to give Moses.
And Moses said, I need it now. And he collects it. Makes sense? That's the idea. Okay, let's move on. We have other things I want to talk about, which is interesting to get to. Now, I don't mind the questions. I want to keep going. Let's see here. Does make a sanctuary for me, blah, blah, blah. Okay, all the stuff. So we have gold and silver, this is verse 4. Gold and silver and copper and blue and red and purple wool and linen and goat hair and ram skin. Don't ask me what a Takish skin is. I know our Bibles translate from dolphin to badger to anything you want. You know what? I'm not going to discuss that topic. You can, yeah, let him discuss it, because in Judaism, they claim is it an extinct animal that is no longer existent anymore. We don't know which one it is. That's their current philosophy. It would not likely be an unclean animal. Not likely, because, hello, look what you're doing with it. The chance of being a badger or a dolphin is almost zero, because those are unclean animals. But what the animal is, no one knows. They perceive it as a multicolored or a many different shaded animal. But that's just a perception alone. So let's move on. What was that? Chameleon. Yeah, maybe not. They're just as bad. Acacia wood, they have oil. There's olive oil. There's spices and anointing oil, incense, and various precious stones. This is verse 4, 5, and 6 or so, and 7. All the various things they have to set aside and use it for. All these things that they're collecting and things that they've collected while they were in Egypt and what they were all putting it away. Now, of course, these people have set it aside. They didn't necessarily know what it was for. This is the mental instruction, a mental idea of setting aside for God. Because God did not tell them ahead of time when they were plundering Egypt, by the way, you take all this stuff to give to me. Right? They didn't tell them that. There wasn't no verbal instruction, no written or nothing. It was just take the stuff. We'll discuss later what it is. But they agreed when they heard the Ten Commandments, everything you say, we will do. So even if they didn't know about it, it doesn't make any difference. They now know whatever he says, we all agreed, we'll do it. Whether we thought it was a good idea or thought it was a bad idea, it makes no difference. I may not like the person I'm giving assistance to, but if this is who God put before me, so I do it as best I can. I don't know why, it doesn't matter, you do it anyway. So let's move forward here. Excuse me. Verse 8, of course, they're going to make these things. Now, God, of course, is describing what these things are making. He repeats himself later on. God, and Moses, actually, not God, but Moses does. He repeats himself when they actually are building it. They say, oh, well, this is how much it weighed, this is its dimensions, this is so-and-so who built it. But they repeat all this stuff later on. So when the Bible repeats something to you, it's not by accident. It's on purpose. Because God could have said, make this stuff, and Moses said, yeah, we did that, check. Anything else? Moses doesn't do that. He says, now I'll describe everything we made. And he repeats, essentially, everything God says later on in the Torah of what was actually built in Exodus. Just repeat the whole thing over and over and over again. Well, that's excessive, isn't it? We're not dumb people. We can see, God says this, we did it. Yeah, we did it. Three words. Moses could have taken off like 6 chapters of writing with just 3 words. We did it. But he didn't. He wanted it repeated. Anytime you repeat something, it's on purpose. Means it's important. It matters. It means something to God. What was that? The two repetitions? They're similar, but not always the same. When there's... Yeah. It's important to understand when there are differences, there's a reason why the difference. Pay attention to differences. When they're the same, it just verifies the difference means something. So watch those differences. Because they're subtle, but they're there. I will go through all the different... Repetition. We learn that, for example, here's an example of a good difference, which you all will understand and follow. Samson. Remember Samson and Delilah? When Samson was about to be born, or when Manoah's wife was going to become pregnant, Manoah's wife was going to become pregnant. When the angel came to her and said, and just describes this story about Samson's birth, what's going to happen. And of course, the angel describes one phrase, that he will deliver Israel from the enemies in his life, or during his life. He'll deliver Israel from his enemies. And then later on, when he repeats the phrase to her again in the presence of Manoah, he says, he'll deliver Israel until his death. Now you add 2 phrases together, that means he will deliver Israel from their enemies through his death. when you add both together. So the similarities is the same statement, but the difference is one was through his death and one's through how he was alive, is that his life-to-death transition will be the process by which he delivers Israel. We add them up. And what do we learn about Samson? What did he do? Remember the temple, push it down? He killed himself too. Yeah, through his death, by killing himself, he killed a whole bunch of people. So we learn from this addition by two different phrases that are similar, but the differences give us a key as to their point. We can learn from those by adding together and explain what the prophecy was. That through the boy's death, he would deliver Israel. Hence, if we follow that, mostly makes sense. So when you see subtle differences between two things that are seemingly the same, they're on purpose. Watch the differences. You can add them up and find out what the differences tell you. Let's move forward. So that's why God repeats himself. He's very good at doing so. Question for you. My next question. Verse 9. Verse 25. Like everything that I show you, the form of the tabernacle, the form of its vessels, and so shall you do. So this implies that God showed Moses what these things look like, right? This would look like this, or look similar to that, that kind of thing that Moses did. Now, we don't know everything that God showed Moses. We have a general idea of what Moses built. We don't know what he actually saw. He didn't say, hey, his photograph, click, look at this. We have an idea of what it is, but he described it in words. However, we have something else too. What did Ezekiel see and what did John see? Now, when Ezekiel see, well, let's jump there. Ezekiel chapter 1. I want to grab your attention in particular, focus your attention particularly on the ark that's being made. Now, we understand in Exodus, I will draw a quick sketch up here. I have a picture somewhere. Oh, here it is. Thank you. This is an artist's interpretation of what the ark may have looked like. Right or wrong, doesn't matter. It has two poles. This has a big light in the middle of it that you really can't see much. But there's two angels with their wings, or two cherub wings, covering a part over the ark. And of course, it has a lid and a basic stand, a box that it's in. This is what he perceives, the description in the Torah looks like, which is probably reasonably close. It has four corners, it has crown molding, it has the poles to go through it, which you can carry the thing. And then we learn during David's time, nobody gets to touch the ark because it'll kill you. So hence the poles. Don't ask me how it happened, I don't really care. So this is how his design is. If you recall, let's go read it. Ezekiel chapter 1. Oh, what was your...
Bush, like he was looking into the fire. And right. Then I turned to that and it was like Ezekiel saw fire.
Yeah, saw fire. He saw
into
light.
The fire,
yeah,
and that's
this
where his vision
glowing
came
appearance.
From.
Let's we're going to read that. Ezekiel chapter 1, starting in verse 4. Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out from the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, each one had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. They had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each held the face of a man, each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side, each of the four had a face on the ox on the left side, and each of the four had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. Their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of each one touched one another, and two were down over their bodies. Each one went straight forward, and they went wherever the spirit wanted to go. They did not turn when they went. As the likeness of living creatures, their appearance like a burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of torches, fire was going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Let's stop there for a minute. We'll keep reading in a minute. We'll finish off the chapter in a minute. So far we see it's a bright light. There's four creatures around it of all these different faces and these wings they have on them. Look at that box again. Now, we see light and fire, the artist's interpretation. I count how many? One, a cherubim this side, two, I count two. Two cherubim, two creatures, two beings around this thing, right? Now, what does Ezekiel describe? Four, and one, as John points out, at each corner. So Ezekiel does not describe these two characters. He describes rather one here, one at this corner, one at that corner, one at that corner. He does have them on the curtains, exactly. They're drawn out or etched or embroidered, whatever it is, on the curtains as well. In Ezekiel's description, it doesn't quite match the box we have here. Because God doesn't live in a box. Yeah, good pun, right? I thought that was funny. Nobody else did. I thought I did. So when you're looking, draw that out. When you're looking at this box, I'm going to draw a top view down because that's easier. So a top view down. So you have a box of that which just has poles in it. But in the throne of God, and mind you, the seat, what those angels, their wings on the box over there in the ark, were supposed to represent God's seat, or a chair, or a place he was sitting. So this is a top-down view. You got, you know, angels with their wings. Angels with wings. Oops, I can draw terribly. I do it for a living, and I can't do this, right? Oh well, it's top view. So angel wings, he's sitting down in front of the box in front of the light. But in Ezekiel's description, top view looking down again, you have this, I'm going to draw as a box, I don't know what it actually looks like, a box, a square, whatever it is, a seat. And you have an angel over here with lots of wings, looks like little calves, bowls, whatever, on all four. This description in Ezekiel and John does not match this description here. So Moses, if he was trying to make things according to what he saw, he didn't see this, which Ezekiel and John saw. Rather, God didn't show him this. God must have shown him, rather, this over here with the two cherubim as opposed to four. Right? Makes logical sense. God said, make it to what you've seen, what I showed you. He has two here, and there's tons on here. They're all around. This drawing of this curtain shows one here. It's an artist's interpretation that there's only one. There could be dozens. So we don't know the number embroidered on the curtain does not describe the number. It just says there should be inscribed along its length. However many there are, how many will fit. We don't know if they were the size of a little dollar bill. For what? This description part? That's actually, this I just looked at English alone, as far as what the cherubim were described. Yes, Anne.
So Ezekiel's vision may be forecoming.
It's possible. Time. It's possible. Now, God never changes. So if God never changes, the likelihood of him changing his throne's appearance is probably slim. Not saying no, but probably slim, because he doesn't change. So his throne probably appeared similar his whole existence of its creation, as opposed to him modifying it later on. Maybe it was not comfortable the first time. I don't know. Yes, Rose.
Throw out a suggestion.
Go right ahead.
A possibility.
That's fine.
That those four angels could represent Reuben, Judah, Ephraim, and Dan. Because those are the tribes that sat on the four sides of the tabernacle.
Now
they
you're
were
going,
the heads of yeah, the four tribes.
Unfortunately, when you use that terminology, that phrase you just said, you jumped ahead of me by half an hour. So slow down. I'll get there later. I got 30 minutes before I get there. But yes, we'll talk about that. Yes. Larry.
One of the things that I've noticed is that on the one with the two cherubim, they still have four wings. They're stretched out, almost touching.
There are similarities. Yeah, there are similarities. Absolutely right. There are some similarities, but not quite the same. I want to bring something to your attention. Just one thing. This is, we'll discuss more what Rose pointed out in a minute. But of all the various items, the altar, the table showbread, the other things which we'll read about later on, the altar of incense, none of them say to leave the staves inside the item. So the altar, the bronze altar, which they have all the animal sacrifice, the staves are made of bronze. They don't stay inside the altar. They pull them out and set them aside. All of them, the staves, are pulled out and set aside, except one piece of furniture. The Ark Covenant, the staves, always remain in it. Now, in Ezekiel's description, look very closely when we read that. What was so strange about these four creatures? They're alive, but do they turn? No. They always go straight forward all the time. I don't know how that happens. They look at each other, they're always moving forward. Whatever forward means, they're always moving forward. They don't move, they're like, I'm using this term loosely, like an inanimate object, but they are alive. Right? Now their job appears to be carrying or being part of God's throne, right? What are the staves used for on our God's covenant's ark? To carry it. And are they ever allowed to be removed? No. They don't rotate or come out at all. They could, but they're not allowed to. They're supposed to stay there. I will argue this. Those four creatures that Ezekiel sees are represented rather instead of by these two cherubim, but rather by the staves themselves. The carrying mechanism. That's what they would represent. I say that because let's keep reading in Ezekiel. Yes, the cherubim and Ezekiel were represented by those staves more accurately than the two cherubim on top of the ark. Yes, Diane.
Just a thought. What about the four angels or the four cherubim represent and execute his commandments everywhere? Yes.
It's possible. If you interpret it as being a representation of the four corners of earth, you could view it that way. But we'll discuss this shortly. Hold on a minute. Let's continue on in Ezekiel chapter 1. How did this thing move? Verse 15 of Ezekiel chapter 1. Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each of the living creatures with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their works were like the color of beryl, and if four had the same likeness, the appearance of their works was where a wheel was in the side of another wheel. When they went toward any one of the four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. As for their rims, they were so high, they were awesome, and their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. When the creatures went, the wheels were beside them. When the creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up too. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went, because where the spirit went, and the wheels were lifted up together with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went. When those stood, these stood. When those were lifted up, the earth, the wheels lifted up the earth, together with them. The spirit of living creatures was in the wheels. So, let's look at this instead of a top view, now from a side view, shall we? my eraser went, here it is. This is why I'm pointing out this is most likely what really God was trying to show to Moses. Side view. I have a box. It has little angels on it with heads and wings, right? Whatever. The box can't move. The staves don't move. The spirit, now mind you, when we refer to the term spirit in a biblical sense, it means your activity or ability to animate. That's what spirit means. Your ability to animate. So as long as I can move, I have a spirit. When I'm not moving, I'm dead. Okay? I'm no longer animated. So the ability of these creatures to live, so their spirit, which their ability to move, was all inside the wheels. Hence, Ezekiel said, they didn't do anything. They just stood there. And the wheels did all the act to actually working. When this box is moving, how is it moved? By men. The poles, and people have to carry it. So I have a man, although a stick figure, a man here, Now, we'll learn later, it's carried by four men. It's a heavy box. There's a lot of gold in that box. So you have, and I drew it, you know, a straight shot, but behind him would be another man. I'll draw him back here. Another man over here. Four men carrying it. So when you are carrying something, what in you is able to move? Your legs, your feet. You're carrying this heavy weight with your arms. Are your arms doing other things? No, they're carrying the heavy weight over your shoulder. What is moving? Your feet. If you want to go somewhere, do you say, oh, hey, wait, let's turn this way? What happens if you would do that? If you had this pole behind you and you let go of it and told me, let's turn this way, everybody. Yeah, it's going to drop. You'll probably be, you know, a broken back when you're done. Everybody else will be mad at you because you broke the box they were carrying. And they're going to be say, you're no longer allowed to do this anymore. Go away the back of the line. You're now expelled. You'll be replaced. So instead, what do you do? Everybody turns. Okay, everybody, let's start turning to the right. Let's start turning to the left. Always face forward. Right? Do you ever turn around? No. You're not going to walk backwards. Yeah, everybody turns around. Hence, the description Ezekiel gives, what is he actually giving? He's giving a description of the men who are carrying the box. The four living creatures are the men carrying the box. What was that? Working, yeah, working together as a unit. Their feet move. Their feet become their eyes. Where are we going? Everybody, let's head to the right. Okay, our feet start turning to the right. Slowly turn to the right. Okay, got it? Okay, now keep moving. The feet are the ones who are guiding them. Hence, the description Ezekiel's seeing, which is a spiritual description, is a description of the box being carried. So when Moses is seeing the vision he sees, God does not show him the four living creatures as if they should be part of the box. They're separate. They're unique. They're human in Moses' time, as far as we represent human beings. So that's how the description looks different than what Ezekiel and what John describe. Any questions? What part do you not agree with me on, dear? So which part do you perceive the four living creatures? That's okay. You're welcome to ask any questions you wish. The point is that that's what Ezekiel appears to be describing. He's describing the men who are carrying the box, hence what Moses built, was not quite the same as Ezekiel describes. Let's move forward. What's in the box? There's manna, a jar of manna. What else in the box? Aaron's staff, which we haven't gotten there yet, but it'll be there eventually. Aaron's staff will get in the box. This big box contains 10 commandments. And it will have Aaron's staff, which budded. We'll put little leaves on it. And it will have a jar or a container of manna. If it doesn't fit inside, it'll fit next to it. It's debatable where it actually goes. So there's some manna, a little jar here. It has little bread pieces inside. Inside or out, no one really knows. So this is God's throne. What does God's throne then contain? No, not God. It can't contain God. What can it contain? It contains... Sorry, one point at a time. The Ten Commandments are representative of what?
Testimony against us.
Well, not against us. No, it's not against us. One God, there's only one God. That's a for us, not against us. But the Ten Commandments are representative. They are like headlines, so to speak, of the actual laws. If I say don't kill, that should not murder. And then there's a whole bunch of laws explaining what murder is, what murder is not. Tentacles, that's okay. So the Ten Commandments represent the entire Torah. That is their function. They're representative of the whole thing because inside any law is a whole list of explaining how you do or conduct that law. So when God, when he sits down having his mercy seat or his seat of judgment or throne of judgment sitting on top, I'll draw, you know, this cloudy thing on top because I don't know what it looks like. He's sitting on top. Yeah, the Shekhinah. What is he sitting on? He's sitting on his instructions. His words. That's what he's sitting on. So when you are judging, when God's judging someone, what's he comparing it to? To what he's sitting on. What's in the box? The box contains the commandments and this stick. Haggadah is more like a story, but the Haggadah is more of a story design, but the idea of this is it's like a scroll or a list idea. Okay, here's my list of what the rules say, like a judgment. Here's, the law says this, you did that. All right? That's what the Torah would be. That's what the commandments represent. But I want to jump to this little staff, which we'll learn about, is put in there too. The staff was a unique thing. What was the staff? Do you remember what the staff was about? Against rebellion. The staff represented an anti-rebellion. Too many eyes there. Rebellion, close enough. against rebellion. Is who else? Okay, do two else. Thank you.
A comfort.
A comfort. Could we argue a comfort? Now the staff. What kind of staff was it? It was a walking stick, or they're not sure it's walking or counting. Either one are still used. Counting is where you mark it as far as you're counting sheep. But what kind of wood was it? Remember? Almond wood.
God must like almonds. Did we make the menorah out of it?
Yep. Because almonds represent what? What are these?
Eyes.
Yep. Almonds represent that. That's their objective. So when he says he has Aaron's staff sprouting almonds, it had buds, ripe fruit, and leaves, and flowers. The whole thing was there. All different parts of all the staff. What's he saying? I see everything. From beginning, the little buds, to the end, ripe fruit. I see everything. It's all seen. Now, I see almonds represent the eyes because Jeremiah said so. Almonds represent eyes. In case you're curious, Jeremiah tells you almonds represent eyes. That's what they are. So, hence the eyes of God and the menorah, all that stuff. So we learned this stuff. So when God's saying, here's my list of my instructions, my tenets I'm standing on. This is my judgment seat, the seat I stand, my throne that I decide, you know, right, wrong, left, right, whatever. It's saying that I have my list, of course, it's your list, and inside me, I see everything. From the very beginning to the very end. Nothing isn't seen. Now, on this staff, we also learned when this got in the box that God chose at the same time. When they chose Aaron. The purpose of the staff, what was used for the time, which we'll read about when we get there in Numbers, the Korah's rebellion. God was demonstrating, I am choosing Aaron. I'm not choosing everybody else. I am making a selection. So in my seeing process, my almonds I'm seeing, I am choosing two. I am selecting someone. So when we expect to go over this judgment seat, so to speak, someday we'll all be there. We have our list of what we did. He saw everything. And what we're supposed to do. He knows a lot of stuff too. He sees everything. No mistakes. Who makes the choice? He chooses. He chose Aaron. That's our... When we're in front of judgment seat, there is no more choices anymore. There's no judgment seat. The choices are done. You can't go back, oh, let me fix that. It doesn't work anymore. But at his point, it's the choice. Our choices. Now, who did he choose among all of us to represent us? Messiah. So, in his choices, he decides who he chooses. He chose Aaron. He chose Messiah. So, when we're standing there, we stand there alone. No, we're not. As long as this stick is in the box, we remember Messiah is there with us in this box. He's there along our side. He's part of this decision-making process because God chose him. Make sense? This box represents God's throne. It combines what his instructions are. He sees everything and the one he chose. Bach represents all of them. And this is his judgment seat. And you're eventually will stand in front of it. Well, he's the representative, the person who's there in front of you that says, I'm in front, God. Yeah. You're like your attorney, so to speak. Yes, Larry.
I think it's very telling that it may be his judgment seat, but he calls it his mercy seat.
Yes, because that's what does he give from it?
Mercy.
That's the whole point. He knows what you did. It's okay, now we're going to see what we do about it. We'll discuss what we do about it with the Leviticus and all the various animals. We'll discuss what all those mean later. We'll discuss them today. Let's move a little bit further. I'll give you a break in 5 minutes. Oh, what was that? Idols. Oh, right. I can talk about those too. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I'm seeing all the elements of covenant within there.
Yeah.
The blessings and curses and the Ten Matters, the Ten Commandments. I see the staff as the authority, which is like the power of attorney given to Moses to represent God. It had at least three miracles associated with it or more.
Yeah.
Did you talk about the manna?
I didn't talk about that yet, no.
Okay.
It's a bit beyond the scope of today's discussion, because the manna is something we have to talk about when we actually discuss and see and what God says with the manna. But we'll discuss it hopefully soon. I can't talk about it just today. That is a big discussion. That is a big discussion. I don't want to go into it today. But there's parts that we'll discuss the manna sometime later. I'm not sure when, but we'll get to it. Yeah, someday. okay, a couple more minutes. We'll give you a break. So as Daniel asked earlier, which is part of my notes, your question about, don't make an image of any of your God commandment. Which commandment is that? No making images of your God. Yeah, the second commandment. Yeah. Number two?
Yeah, nothing.
Yeah, either what you see of the earth, in the earth, under the earth, or in heaven above. So how do we rectify this instruction, commandment number two, with the cherubim written drawn up here, the ones etched out on the curtains of these characters, these beings have faces and they have their stuff on them and all that stuff. How do we rectify that? Ah, that's one idea to guard. Go ahead, what's your thoughts?
Well, it's the same as like, do not murder, and then God commands the Israelites to enter the land of Canaan and not leave any woman or child.
Yep,
even.
Don't let them.
Because he specifically told them to.
Because I said so is a legit argument. What was that? Because it said so, yeah. It is a fair argument. That's absolute. And a lot of commandments are written that way. Don't do this. Why is that? Just because he said so, just don't do it. That's sufficient. A lot of commandments were argued that way. And I agree with you 99% of it. As somebody, I don't know who it was, rattle off. What is worshiping? What is idolizing? What does that mean? Okay, I don't know about people, but you could. You guys are people, yes. What does it mean?
You're putting that above God and putting that as the most important thing or more important than anything else.
To idolize. Now, anything can be converted into an idol, right? Any person can be converted to an idol, right? Can you idolize yourself?
Yes.
Can you idolize your God? Can you idolize your Messiah? It's interesting discussion about what this means. To idolize is to lift something up higher than it belongs or than it should be. Right, so can you idolize your Creator? Yeah, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yes! So our Creator can be idolized. Can you make... He's not your Creator. We're the Creator of heaven and earth. You know, God, the Father, the one God. So, Creator. Now, can you idolize? Yes, you can idolize. What does that mean? Can you lift him higher than he belongs? No. You can't. So is it falsely idolizing him? No. It's correctly idolizing him. Because you're lifting up as high as you can possibly lift him, and there is no higher. Can you do that wrongly? No, you can't. So idolize your Creator, that's a good thing. We want to idolize him as that he is greater over all. Right? Because he says, There's only me. No one is greater. Nothing is greater. I'm alone. It's just me. There is no 10, 20,000, 500 gods. It's just me. I'm alone. It's all me. So you can't create or can't idolize him any lower. It's not possible. So idolizing something isn't evil. It's what you idolize that might be evil, not the act of idolizing. So idolizing a creator, you couldn't possibly do that wrong. You can't go wrong. So that's not a problem. Can you idolize an apostle? Is that right or is that wrong? That's wrong. Can you idolize our Messiah? Yes. Is that right or is that wrong? It's wrong. Messiah said, the Father is greater than I am. Right. So, but idolize means to lift something up higher than it belongs. So Messiah, the creator, you can't. It's not physically, conceptually possible. Right. So someone could idolize him, not where it belongs, or not it. And we'll discuss what all those things mean some other time. So you can idolize a Messiah, but he cannot be greater than the one who created him, right? Yeah, so he's always lower than. You can idolize tons of stuff and tons of people. Can you idolize an idea? Yes, you can. Some goal or objective can be greater than what it should be or where it belongs. And Paul thinks about that. And my fish experience a couple weeks back was about that. I really wanted to go play. Nope, I had to take care of the fish instead. Because the right thing was take care of the fish because it was sick. It died anyway, by the way. Too bad. The fish died. My fault. Anyway, so you can idolize an idea of what you want to do still greater than where it belongs. It doesn't belong there. You cannot reshuffle things and idolize things greater. So we have to carefully identify what it means to idolize or bring them before God as if it is greater than him or equal to him or whatever you want to envision or say. So when we're discussing this topic, now let's go back to... I erased it already, I think. Yeah, I did. Go back to these little characters up here. These cherubim, or even the ones in the curtains, or even these furniture items, or anything in this whole entire tabernacle or temple. Can you idolize any one of those things? Yes, you could. Is it proper? No, it's not. Nothing is proper to idolize in this. Now, did God give these items their place? Yes. So who defined their place? God did. Don't lift it up greater than he put, but don't bring it down either. So let's go back to our earlier discussion. You can idolize creator. Can you disgrace or lower him?
Yes.
Is that right or wrong? Wrong. You can idolize Messiah. Can you disgrace or lower him?
Yes.
Is that right or wrong? Wrong. So just because we don't bring it higher, bring it lower. Don't take the Lord your name God in vain. I mean, don't make it worthless. Don't make it unimportant or insignificant. No value. Is just as wrong as lifting it up. Idolizing it. You're putting it before God. Say, hey, this is greater than you thought it was, God. You made a mistake. Here, you should fix it. Or, God, this thing you said was really important, it really isn't. I'm going to disgrace it and put it down here. It doesn't really matter. Both are incorrect. Both break a commandment. Don't go higher. Don't go lower. God said it. This is where it belongs. He chose. Yes.
Just one question. As far as, statues and carvings and just, like, art in general, like, say you have, like, a sculptures and whatever. Is it wrong to make sculptures then, or like, anything like that? Is that...
Well, somebody had asked me that a couple of years back, and I said, that's absurd, because look at all the various things God had them make.
Yeah.
These were artists. Very good at what they did.
Yeah.
Now, I also got the same argument with the same person at the same time, coincidentally, was an artist. They had argued that, well, but art really isn't work either. It's play. Play, you're creating. But God said on the sixth day he rested from his work. What did he call it? He called creating work. So God, the ultimate of artists, said creating art people is still work. You may not think of it as work, but it is work. And we'll read more when he goes through the Torah section later on. When the people are actually building it, he says, hey, artists, don't forget, you have to take Shabbat off. He tells them, You have to take Shabbat off. You can't work then too. You can't keep creating. So, yeah, creating things isn't the problem. Lifting them up or lowering them where they belong, that's your issue. Yes.
Whether it's work or play, people make money off of it all the time. That's work.
That's true.
So, you know, and even beyond. But back on the whether or not it's okay to even have
rate them
sculptures
or whatever.
Or whatever, if I remember correctly, even in the Ten Commandments, there's a qualification that says, "Do not make them to worship."
Yeah, raise them or lower them.
Right.
Where they
belong. So he puts that qualification in there. He's not saying you can't have a picture of Israel.
So your garden gnome on your garden is not necessarily worshiping gnomes.
Right.
And they don't worship anything. Don't kick it; they break easy. Daniel, your hand was up. Go ahead. I need to take a break. You got a 10-minute break, but go ahead.
So it would be possible to look at any of the objects in the tabernacle and idolize them.
It is.
But it would be next to impossible to idolize the Shekinah glory, which was always present and not able to put.
You can't touch it. You could see, you could feel, you could. It can't fit in a box. It's just there. So you can't. So in the idea of light or God's presence cannot be. You can't possibly lift it up higher than it is. It's as high as you can imagine lifting it. So, hence, that's how we address the issue of the creating of all these cherubim inside the tabernacle. Is that the point is, creating them isn't the problem. It's what you do with them, how you treat them, what you act toward them, whether they are decorative items or are they not decorative items. These are decorative items. It's really just made of gold and silver and things that the tarnished things, the fabric, they'll decompose over time. You have to replace them, all that stuff. They may symbolize something else, meaning something else that God is trying to per se to help you understand, but they are, in fact, decorative items. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, you see an example of the idolization of that later on in Israel's history, like in Yirmiyahu, where you have the people saying, you know, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, and he flattened it.
Yep. Crush it down. You idolize, you start idolizing the whole building. That's the whole thing you can't lift it up higher than it is. It's really important. We take a break. Go ahead, Carrie. Last comment, we'll take a break.
I was just thinking, even the event where the man tried to save the ark when it was falling and he died because God said, don't touch it with your hands.
Right.
So that was still kind of an instance of a person either lifting himself up higher, thinking he could take better care of it than God can, or lifting the item up higher than God had said we're to keep it in our minds.
That's an interesting point. That event for that man's death is all upon King David. He caused it. And so when we learn from what King David understood when this man died, doing what King David knew he should not have done, King David screwed up. And when he saw he screwed up, he realized, wait a minute, I caused this man's death. Because the ark is told you will carry it on four people on their shoulders. And David said, no, don't let people touch it. Put it in a crate, in a box, in this cart, and drag it with animals. I assume the other people carried it. I don't know who put it in the box. Somebody put it in the box. Put it in the crate. And the man, now God said, don't carry my throne this way. But David ordered it. And so the man obeyed. Oh, I will do it. Okay, I'll do what David king. He's the king, right? And so he died all because David disobeyed God's instructions that you will not carry my ark this way. So the response to the man's death, that we thought we should have stabilized and help it out, if it was being carried by four men, would it ever be unstable? No. Because each, when the men fall, that could happen, but hopefully not. You look where they're going, right? It would be more stable. But it was being resting in a box, which is not stable as it goes over rough roads. It was a poor designed idea that David had. And that responsibility is squarely on his shoulders, not the man who died. Yes.
Just one comment on that is that there's a verse in the New Testament that says, you know, God over man, follow God over man. So the other guy screwed up too. He should have said, no, God
better.
Didn't say that. That's not, no, I'm not going to follow you on this one because God overruled you on that.
Yep. That's true. He should have said, God said, don't do this. let's take a 10-minute break. I have another topic to talk about.
God has never said, don't do all these things.
Don't hewn the stone. You'll profane the stone. We're going to learn more about tabernacle as we learn more about its layout. Up here, which is, Jeff's trying to get a shot of it more closely. Now, the tabernacle layout is not spelled out in this Torah portion. It will be later on. I'm only going to highlight a few minor details that Rose brought out a little while ago regarding the tabernacle layout, because it's relevant a little bit to something else which we didn't read about, which we're about to read next, which was John's description of what this whole temple and throne and all that stuff looked like. So let's jump to Revelation a little bit and discuss and read a small section of what he had recorded in order to explain a little bit more about what Moses is building and how it's supposed to look. So we learn from Revelation chapter 4 of the book of Revelation discusses, this is also recorded similarly to Ezekiel 1. Revelation chapter 4 says, after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. The first voice I heard was like of a trumpet speaking with me, saying, come up here. I will show you the things which must take place after this. I was immediately in the spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. He who sat there was like a jasper and sardis stone in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne in appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold on their heads. And from the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices. There were 7 lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are 7 spirits of God. Before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal in the midst of the throne, and around the throne were 4 living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, the third like the face of a man, the fourth was like that of a flying eagle. And the 4 creatures, each having 6 wings, were full of eyes all around within. They did not rest day nor night, saying, holy, 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 Lord of God Almighty, who was and is to come. Verse 9. Whenever the living creatures gave glory and honor and thanks to him who sits on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fell down before him who sits on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. You created all things, and by your will they exist and were created. I just read this, Revelation chapter 4, discussing what John sees when he's looking through and he's visioning this vision of God's throne, which, of course, the rest of the book he discusses interacting with it. I bring something to your attention. The throne is not just by itself, right? There's other things around it, right? Such as, of course, the 24 elders are around the throne. Now, in Moses' tabernacle, do we have a description that represents the 24 elders at all? Not really. We really don't. So, either God was not interested in recording or placing the 24 elders amongst his throne, or we might be missing something. Yes, Deanne.
I heard this before, but there's a timing going on with some of this, because when John was up in the heavens like that, at one point there was no one worthy of opening up the scroll. And then when Messiah showed up, then the scroll was able to be opened. So in my opinion, it looks like there's different time frames where, because God knows the beginning from the end. So we're seeing one time frame, but there's another time frame
as it transitions. Yeah, it's recorded in Revelation chapter 5. We'll just Revelation chapter 5 and continue on our reading. Revelation 5 describes this timing that you're referring to, Deanne. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. Then I saw a strong angel proclaim with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and loose its seals? And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or look at it. So I wept much, because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. But one of the elders said to me, do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals. And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures, in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb, as though it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out to all the earth. He came and took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and a golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. They sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and you have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." Let's stop there for a minute. This is in Greek, so I don't know. I don't have a Septuagint with me to know what it says as far as the Greek. I couldn't answer the question. I don't know. If it has over versus on, I don't know. But I want to point something out to you. The statements. Who's speaking in this prayer? When these people are bowing down and worshiping the Lamb, as far as they you're worthy the scroll, your blood, blah, blah, blah. Verse 9, you have redeemed us to God by your blood. Yes, who is speaking though? No, John's recording it. Who's speaking? The elders are saying it. Now, this is bizarre. Listen very carefully. Are the elders, are they flesh and blood, or are they spirit? They're spirit, right? Now, they each had crowns and thrones, as is recorded earlier in the exact same chapter, right? So, if they're spirit, what need do they have of the Lamb's blood to redeem them? But these men aren't in the past. No, they're right here in this story as it's actively happening. So as we read in Revelation 5, as it discusses what he's seeing, and 4 as well, of course, discuss the fact they're all around it, they're already there around God's throne prior to the Lamb showing up. So they're already there. We're getting there. Dan, we're agreeing. I'm just pointing out how we're getting there. So they're already there. But a spirit is already a spirit. The spirit, the 24 elders, are already in heaven. As clearly, because it's around God's throne. Because I'm not living there. I'm not in heaven. But they're living there. They're already in heaven. So we have to ask ourselves, they're saying the Lamb who's redeemed us by his blood. Now they're already dead. They're already up there. They already exist. They're already up there with God. We have to explain, how is that possible? And is it explained or shown to us in Moses' tabernacle? I argue it is. Go ahead.
My version doesn't say us.
Oh, what does it say? What does it say?
At the cost of blood, you ransomed for God. For God.
I'll have to find out. I'm not sure I don't have a Septuagint with me. Do you have a comment on it?
We're looking at what, verses 9 and 10?
Verses 9 in particular. Okay. Verse 9
so,
in particular.
If you're reading the New American Standard, it says, and they, referring to these elders, sang a new song saying, worthy are you to take the blood and to break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priest to our God, and they will reign upon the earth. But if you look at the the Septuagint is only a Old Testament.
Right, that's what they have. It's just right. They have the new
the Greek of the Old
Greek,
Testament.
The Greek, they have Greek versions of this phrase.
But I do have a Peshitta New Testament.
Oh, that
which
works.
Is
that's Aramaic.
Which is the English translation of an Aramaic.
Right.
And their version of verse 9 says, and they sung a new anthem saying, competent art thou to take the book and to open the seals thereof, because thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood. out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and thou hast made them kings and priests to our God, and they reign on the earth. So in the Aramaic, they do use that.
The word us.
Elders are saying us.
I'll have to find out what seven or eight different Greek manuscripts. Find out which one actually used the word us in the verse 9. So they? Us as well, right.
Song saying, thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof.
Have redeemed us to God by your blood.
For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred.
I'll find out. My objective, however, was to identify who the 24 elders are. Who are they? Go ahead. It's possible. It could be apostles versus a tribe identification. I point out to you, does Moses give us an indication who the 24 are?
No, I don't know.
That's what we're going to talk about. He does give us an indication of 24 are, and we're going to discuss that right now because it was, we read part of it in our Torah portion today, who some of them are. Anne, your hand is up.
They are what's referred to as in Abraham's bosom because they're waiting for that redeemed.
That's possible. Now, we learn later on that the people who have been slain on behalf of it are asleep still. God has not resurrected them yet. So it's possible there may be some other representation. I do not know. In order to find out who 24 might be, you'd look at Moses' temple or his tabernacle and find out where do you find the number 24 showing up. And you don't. But in Moses' tabernacle, you do find something else showing up. Which, Moses' tabernacle in Exodus, you find something else showing up. It shows two sets of 12.
Oh, yeah, it's right.
Yes. So, the showbread, which hangs out here, has one set of 12. The 12 tribes of Israel, right? So we have the set of 12 sitting up here inside the showbread. That's our first example of 12. Now, it is inside. It's of God's presence. Now, 12 is not 24, but it's the first set of 12 shown up. The second set of 12, which we'll read more about as we get to the layout, there are around God's tabernacle are 12 tribes encamped. That is our second set of 12 listed. So if we're looking at God's throne, which represented by that by the ark itself, and the 24 around it, the only 24 example we're given are two sets of 12, the 12 loaves of bread, and the 12 tribes that are surrounding the entire tabernacle itself as if it was God's whole kingdom. That would represent what those symbols could be. Yes, Daniel. The apostles aren't part of it. In Moses' description, we don't know which of these represent. The 12 loaves of bread we've interpreted, because it says, for each tribe, represents the tribes. We also know in, I think it's Ezekiel records, the entrances to the temple, in his temple, there's three on each side, making a total of 12. So we have which correspond to the individual tribes, three on each side, which makes sense. Ezekiel tells us that. So we have the three crowns, the three thrones of glory, or 12 thrones of glory. We know, according to Ezekiel, represents these 12 tribes. That's given. He tells us that much. We also know that the cornerstone, or the apostles, also the cornerstone of God's temple, they also are representative of this as well in some capacity. So you can argue that those 12 loaves might represent those 12 apostles. We don't have another example of 12 given to us, but that would imply that the 12 The 24 elders have a glory or an authority assigned to them because they have crowns. They have thrones and crowns. So the representative we have in this tabernacle that Moses gives us, the only way we have in this, is just the 12 tribes and the 12 loaves of bread. Yes, Daniel.
So how many patriarchs were there?
I'm sorry, say it again?
How many patriarchs were there?
Depends on your definition of patriarch, because if you define patriarch as just the three original ones, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's one. If you define them as the tribes, then you have to write all the tribes up as well. Because these tribes, they're the patriarch of their tribe. Then you have the 12 sons, but then Joseph was split in two, making 13. So a total of 13 of the sons, and then of course you have the three original, which would be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So you could have 16 combined patriarchs in that capacity. You could also argue that the Levi, well, I'm not sure how far back you go back. It depends how far back you're going to go. If you divide Levi, because he was broken up into three separate sections, actually four from the high priest, you could argue that would be that there were 20 families, these are loosely, divided up amongst all of the Israelites. 20 different patriarchs, let's say. Yes.
Did the 12 and 12 loaves go on a special feast day?
Every week they were supposed to be replaced, every Shabbat. Every Shabbat, all 12 loaves were replaced with new, freshly made ones. They stayed all week long. Yep. And so no matter what happens, this throne always has 12 loaves in front of it. And when they're moving or carrying around, going places, moving around, you're still surrounded, but you're surrounded in a line as opposed to surrounded like around. But when it's encamped, then all the 12 tribes are around as well. Make sense? So, I can't swear that, you know, the 24 elders correspond to these 24 counts, the 12 loaves, the 12 tribes. But there is some connection between the 24 and these tribes. We know that much because the tribes present a crown or authority. So the elders each have their own crown and authority. It could be, as Rose pointed out, the other 12 may not be the tribes. Maybe they correspond to the apostles too. I don't really know. But we don't have the other 12 listed other than the bread. Yes.
You know the verse too that says in the Psalms, what is it? Psalms 46 that says the sons, the forefathers will become the sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and it says no man has ascended up to heaven except
right.
the Son of Man who came down from heaven. So up until the time when Yeshua
until he died,
came,
no one's been up there.
Right, exactly. And so I think, you know, what we're looking at too from the they're going to be the ones to reign on the earth would be the forefathers of who died in faith without, you know, getting the heavenly reward, you know, so that it should be talking about, yeah, it should be talking about them.
Those men, those people who are in charge, who are responsible. We sometimes, I, at least I do, maybe you guys don't, I've looked at these various tribes and their histories and look, for lack of a better term, down upon some of them.
What?
Because some of them really screwed up. Yeah, it really just like really what were you thinking kind of thing. It's really some dumb things they did. But God assigned each of these men and their tribes as independent, defined beings with their authority and strength and power. And I have to recognize that even though people screw up, I do too, you can't hold it against them. Because it's a temporary thing and they'll move on. So each of these tribes, well, even that, even the continuation, it's still temporary. Maybe multiple generations, but still temporary. Each of these tribes have their authority and strength. Now, as we discussed this a long time ago, when we are adopted into the tribe, into one of these tribes, I don't know which one, we all have our own adoption rules, adoption papers, that we've been accepted as far as that's how you got into God's kingdom, is that you're being adopted. Now, most of it, we argue are adopted by Messiah for dying for us, hence the tribe of Judah. But still, the point is, many tribes, many avenues. Many ways of being adopted or attached to God in spite of your history and your past. So when we look at these different 24 elders, and which may represent these, I don't know. If they do, they have their own authority. Note authority, they're the ones, they themselves don't necessarily have to be the ones who died and are being redeemed to God. Whatever they represent is what's being redeemed to God. Does it make sense? So in Revelation, when we're reading this story, it says redeemed, whether it's to us, or just plain redeemed men to God, they're bowing down, and they're pointing out that you have redeemed whatever we represent, whether it's us biologically, I don't think so, or what we represent, our authority, which I do think so, is what's being redeemed, which means these 24 elders are in charge of a group of things that need redemption. Yeah, how do you do that? How do you do that? You have to have lost it somehow. To redeem an authority, you have to have lost the authority. Else, there's nothing, no redemption is required. I don't believe these 24 ever lost authority of anything. It's the people they represent lost their position. Reuben's example. Someone represented Reuben and his tribe and all his descendants. Well, whoever that was, whatever spirit represents them before God's throne, saying, hey, I'm here on behalf of Reuben. Whoever that was, this is his authority, this is his job, to stand on behalf of Reuben. So, Well, this is, hold on, stop. This is before Messiah. When Reuben's sleeping with Bilhah, Messiah isn't born yet. He is not dead yet. He didn't live his life. He's not there on the scene. This is Reuben. So when I have an angel, I screw up, God, please forgive me. I know God himself isn't looking at my face when I'm talking. Why? Because I can't see him. But I do know my prayers go up to him. Why? Because Jacob said so. Your prayers go up this he has this ladder, stairway, what do you call it, and God's talking, prayers are going up. And the incense that the 24 elders are offering says are prayers of the saints, or prayers of the people. So they have to represent people because it's their incense. So these men are representing their tribes or their group or their authority, their people. Now, they need their people, their tribes, their group redeemed to God. Else none of them make it. There's no point having a throat over something that fails. What do they require? Someone to redeem their people that they represent. Hence, the Lamb did it. So they're praising the Lamb. Thank you. You now took care of all this baggage I have of trying to get these people saved and bring up to God and do the best I can. It's through you that I'm going to happen, that this is going to happen. So I'm not arguing the 24 elders were once humans. I don't think they were. But I think they represent an authority or power to represent their tribes or their group that they were supposed to represent. And that's who's saying, we need this Lamb to save all these people that I represent. Make sense? That's what I'm arguing with. It's not that they are the Messiah for their tribe. They're not. They're representatives of their tribe through the Messiah to get the job done, to save their people, so to speak. That's just the implied by the words given. Because they're praising him for redeeming the people, and they have crowns and authority. They had to redeem somebody. It can't be spirits, because spirits don't need redemption. They're already dead. Does that make sense? Sort of.
No.
Okay. I didn't mean to confuse you. The point was trying to point out that these 24 elders represent groups of people. And these groups of people are then praising, the 24 elders are praising the Lamb for redeeming the groups of people that they represent. Does that make sense? Hopefully. Yes, Larry.
I'm thinking if we talk about elders of our human groups, and although they are people, they represent us.
The whole thing, right.
And we go to them for support and help and get back and forth the spiritual energy to do it. It seems like they're kind of like the spirits of the group. And
yeah.
The Messiah made it possible for them to have a group.
Yep.
Otherwise, they would have, I think you said that, they would have just not been necessary.
Yeah,
there's a spirit of what? Nothing?
Yeah, nothing. Because no one would have survived.
Because nobody would have survived, yeah.
Right, right. So Messiah made this scenario actually possible, make it work. Hence, they're all praising. Not for them, it's who they represented they're doing it for. Exactly. They have a reason that their authority means something now.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to close up real quick in this last few details. Let's see here. Well, I was going to skip a section because the section's a little bit difficult to explain. But I can't skip it completely because it's really important. Because it's important to us as those individuals represented by the 24 elders, we have a job to do. We should know what the job is. I can't neglect that. So the job is recorded in chapter 27 of our reading today. It's 27. Let me double check that real quick. Let's see here. Actually, nope, that's not fair. I can't cover that. That's Jeff's job. As a tail end of chapter 27. He'll cover that next week. But it has to do with the actions of the people as far as the oil of the lamp and what that means and how they apply it, how they use it.
The oil of the lamp.
Because it records early in chapter 25 the things they're collecting. They're collecting oil, they're collecting the blue and the scarlet and the purple and the gold and all that stuff. Amongst them is oil for illumination, which records 25. It records greater detail in chapter 27, the tale of chapter 27 verses 20 and 21 and 22, or 2021, because as far as what they do with how that oil is supposed to work. And we use that as the explanation for Messiah's parable in Matthew 25, the 10 virgins. Because this oil, the people are supposed to give to it, but they're supposed to represent it for us what they're giving. And the oil is used to light the lights. Then we have lights means to see. So God's seeing what you're giving. What you're giving is the oil. We're going to discuss what it means to give. It's not the actual object, but it's the act of giving that matters. And then, of course, how God's viewing your act of giving.
Girls didn't share.
Because like, you can't. You can't share your good actions or your actions. You can't say, oh, I did this, and now I'll give it to you as if you did it. It doesn't work that way. You do it your own. We'll discuss that. Jeff, I'm sure we'll cover it in greater detail next time around. But that act of giving is what God's looking at. And so we look at this tabernacles and the story about Sapphira and Ananias, the dead people in Acts. How were they giving? The story about the widow's mite. How was she giving? So we look at these things that God's looking at, and he's observing and paying attention to us and our actions. What's he looking at? Well, the widow's mite, she gave what? Two or whatever they were. Little trinkets, minor things. They were more valuable than all the silver and gold that were given to her before by other people who were wealthy. And she gave everything she had. Gave her heart behind it. And then the other two who were killed in the book of Acts, what spirit were they using when they gave? They were gave in the spirit of abundance and their glorification. So we understand that giving is an important aspect. So our actions, the oil we use, that the gift we use all the time, God's watching very carefully. That means something. It's not about the oil itself. It's how we're giving it. Whether it's pure, good, or it's garbage, not good, not usable for light. So I'm not going to continue any more of that because it's going in more theological debate and discussing what those mean and arguments and such. Any questions about how this Torah portion is used and is read?
I'm
sure you will. There's a lot of discussions about how these things are used and function in Ezekiel as well as in Revelation as well as this Torah portion. But it's important to remember what they mean because they mean something to us. Their meanings are how we apply them to our lives. If you don't know the meaning, you can't apply anything. You might as well walk away. Any questions or comments? The curtain. Which about it? Which part?
Cherubim on the curtains.
Okay. I won't go into too much detail of that because they're a little bit. First of all, the cherubim are made of blue wool, red wool, purple wool, and linen woven together. That's the embroidery material. It's wool. And the linen itself is the sheet being used that they're stitching it to, so to speak. Yes. That's the key. They're mixing it on purpose because God commanded it. So, yeah, that's a Torah command. Now, if you ever get a chance to read Josephus' explanation of this, he explains it reasonably well. So, there's a Torah command that says you should not mix wool and linen.
Where?
To wear, to put on your clothing. Now, the high priest has a linen tunic. Over that is a wool, mostly blue, wool outer covering garment. And on top of that is a breastplate with woven wool on the straps that is used. And the Torah says, don't mix wool and linen to wear. The high priest is wearing wool and linen. They're layering it, so it's a difference in that way. And in this instance, they're not wearing it, but it is woven together. So we ask ourselves, okay, why? Why would they weave it together? And why is it a problem to wear? And why would God want this? Why would he just say, use dyed linen? It does make a pretty appearance. It does cancel frequencies too, because there's I forgot the two frequencies, like 500 hertz or whatever. There's some hertz frequency. They do cancel throughout. Yeah. So, but Josephus explained something to us, which made things far less complicated than what humans like me make it. He points out the mixture of wool and linen and wearing them is because that is priestly garments only. The priests wore the wool and the linen clothed together. This is his application. He's pointed out that it's no different that when Moses prohibited people from mixing up the anointing oil he used for the high priest, that you were never supposed to mix it for your personal use. Even though some people may have, but you weren't supposed to do that. You could have. Clearly, it's not that hard. And humans have mixed wool and linen for a long time. It's not that hard. The point is, you're not supposed to because it doesn't belong to you. It's not yours. That was his argument. Now, Josephus was around long before I was. I'm not saying he was necessarily right or wrong, but this was his point. This was his explanation. The priests could mix it. It was their garments. It was their clothing. But the ordinary people were not supposed to do so. And the priests wore them in layer fashion, with the exception of the ephod, which was a woven, like a crocheted type of weave, as opposed to whoop and wharf style, like we do fabrics. There was more of a woven style. But they did that for the ephod, which was they would mix them together. So wool and linen, this application, which is being happening here inside the cherubim with the whole stitching up, just like the ephod is, this application has to be associated with a priesthood application. Because they were the only ones permitted to use this application. Here comes your answer now. Whose job was to guard the tabernacle? The priests. The Levites. Who surrounds the tabernacle?
The whole tribe.
No, who's directly around it? Who are the four sides? Up here.
The Levites were
Moses and Aaron, families of Merari, families of Gershon, and families of Kohath. They were immediately surrounding it. Everybody else was outside of them. So when we mix these together and see an example of it, and it's a spiritual example. In this case, a cherubim is a spiritual example because it's not actually a physical thing. It's a drawing. It represents the ones who are allowed to wear those garments, the priesthood. So in the case of these cherubim, the decorative items around the tabernacle, all the fabric around it, they represent representatives or represent the priests of the Levites. Because they're the only ones allowed to wear those garments. And they wore mostly blue. The blue and wool, or blue and linen, and the ephod had a mixture of different colors inside of its weave, which is the purple and the red, and yeah, purple and red as well. Does it make sense? I'm sure it was beautiful. I do not know, but I'm sure it was beautiful. So when we look at those examples, that's how we would use them. Okay, if God said don't do this, but the priest did it, and I'm using this application over here, and it's a spiritual application, and the spiritual, which is the cherubim, the job is a guarding aspect, a guardian type of choice, a guardian task, I should say. The guardian tasks, who represents that inside this diagram up here on our board? The one who represents it would be the priests themselves, the Kohanim. They're the ones permitted to wear those garments. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions? Yeah, Aaron, yeah, the high priest line is over here, and he has his own category at the main entrance, and then the other three groups were their own groupings.
But they all had different
names. Yes, there's Gershon, there's Merari, and Kohath. They had their own different tasks, different jobs they would do. Yeah, there's Merari. He's one of the sons of Levi up here. And there's Gershon. He was one of the sons of Levi over here. And there's Kohath, one of the sons of Levi over here. He literally had three sons. And of Kohath, most there are actually from the line of Kohath, but they are unique because God chose them to be the high priestly line. So they were broke up before.
So it was east family.
On the entrance would be the east side, the entrance, east side.
So
Levites would surround the whole thing. They got all four sides. Make sense? Okay, hopefully that explains it. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat, a day of rest. Thank you for teaching us as best we can. Father, help us to learn, to follow, to understand, and to pursue what is right in your ways. We ask your kindness, Father, be upon us and those whom we love. May you protect us and give us a blessed rest of our Shabbat. We trust you and praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.